Abandoned today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. No more U.S. support for moderate rebels in Syria, and this former rebel general feels betrayed.
The friends of Syrian revolution decided to abandon us and to leave us falling under the Russian and Iranian occupation.
Also, the wife of an ISIS fighter finds an app on her husband's phone.
It was a market for sex slaves. They were sharing photos of them wearing the best makeup and clothes. A virgin cost $10,000.
Plus, there's Justin Trudeau, the environmental hero.
We know that it will be the world's poorest citizens who will be hardest hit by climate change.
But also Trudeau, Canadian pipeline champion.
We're on our way to getting three new pipeline projects underway.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. It's good to have you with us today, a day when we've got a writer who will introduce us to a jihadi who surfs, and we'll hear just how green Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau really is. That's later in the show. Let's talk first about President Trump's plans for Syria. Trump is reportedly pulling the plug on U.S. support for rebel groups fighting the regime of President Bashar al-Assad, specifically a covert CIA program launched under President Obama to arm and train the more moderate rebels in Syria. It's bad news for General Salam Idris, former head of the Free Syrian Army.
The friends of Syrian revolution decided to abandon us and to leave us falling under the Russian and Iranian occupation. And here we Syrians have the right to ask this very important question. Are there agreements and secrets and secret deals being implemented these days at the expense of the blood and sacrifices of the Syrian people? That is our question.
The World's Rich Hall in Beirut says the CIA program was never likely to topple Assad, but was designed instead to give the U.S. some influence on the battlefield.
You had this kind of weird stuff of spy films going on in southern Turkey and in Jordan, where you'd have CIA officers meeting with rebel commanders in hotels in southern Turkey, handing out suitcases full of cash. And we know from reports that fighters were paid around $100 a month and commanders were paid a bit more than that.
My sense is that this program was pretty half-hearted and ineffective all along. I mean, I remember reading that CIA-funded units at one point were shooting at Pentagon-funded troops. I mean, it wasn't exactly a success story, was it?
It wasn't, no. I mean, half-hearted is being generous, I think. So early on, you would have stories and comments from rebel commanders complaining that they weren't getting enough ammunition, for example. They would come to the CIA officers with these plans for operations against Assad, and it would take them weeks to get the bullets. And by the time they got the ammunition and the bullets, they would say, well, this operation's not viable anymore. There was loads of stories like this. And then when the U.S. bombed al-Qaeda in 2014, al-Qaeda started going after a lot of these groups. And some got swallowed up by other groups. Some defected to al-Qaeda. Weapons went missing. That was a big scandal at the time. And there was a sense that the operation was never quite nimble enough. It was never quick enough to keep up with the changing face of the battlefield in Syria, which changed all the time.
What about the rebel units that are funded by the Pentagon? Will that program continue?
That's right. To add to the confusion, there's another separate program where the Pentagon is funding rebel units. These are specifically to fight the Islamic State. And they are made up of a Kurdish and Arab coalition called the SDF. And they are currently fighting in Raqqa and doing very well against ISIS.
Now, I know the Russians were not happy with the CIA-funded program, but is canceling it a way for the U.S. to make an effort toward mending fences with Russia without losing too much face in the war in Syria, or is it too late for that?
Yeah, this is the point that Obama administration officials are making today, that regardless of the ineffectiveness or effectiveness of the program, it did afford the U.S. some leverage in Syria. And who knows what could have been negotiated in return for giving up this program. They could have perhaps negotiated access for humanitarian organizations. There could have been some amnesties, and we'll never know.
What's been the reaction of the rebel groups who were receiving aid and are not now?
So I managed to speak to some rebel commanders through a source of mine, and the first reaction was that they were just shocked. They didn't see this coming at all. And now they're kind of in a wait-and-see mode. They're waiting to see how much of the program is going to be stopped, whether it's going to be all of it or part of it. And some of them are already thinking about other sources of funding.
Mm. What does this mean for U.S. Syria policy and for Syria?
The EU and the U.S. appear to be converging on this matter. Despite all the tough talk, they're kind of recognizing that Assad is probably going to stay. And there's also a recognition that Russia and Iran are kind of running the show in Syria now. And the focus now for the U.S., at least, is purely on defeating ISIS. We had a statement from John McCain before I came on air, and he said that very thing. He said that the administration is playing to the hands of Vladimir Putin.
I mean, this is extraordinary. It's an important milestone, it seems, in the war in Syria. It basically says if removing Assad from power ever was a goal of the U.S. engagement there, it is no longer. So how does this impact the fight against ISIS?
Well, there are some that argue that it will embolden more extremist groups like al-Qaeda and groups like that. But there is this separate Pentagon-run program which is providing support to the Kurdish Arab SDF. And that's, as I say, focused purely on fighting ISIS and is doing very well. Supporters of the Syrian government will say, well, if the government doesn't have to fight these rebel groups, then they can go after ISIS more. And they have been doing that more in recent months as the threat of the rebels is subsiding.
It seems the bottom line here is that just about no one any longer believes Syria's president Bashar al-Assad can be driven from power. Does this mean it's game over?
It does seem that way, yeah. I mean, some would argue that the writing has been on the wall for quite a long time. Russia calculated that the U.S. didn't really want to get too involved in Syria. And in the end, they turned out to be right.
The World's Rich Hall in Beirut. Always good to speak with you. Thanks.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
Millions of Syrians have fled the war in their country over the past few years. Just ordinary people looking for a safe place to live their lives. People like the Das family we met here on the show yesterday. They left Syria in 2015 when ISIS captured their hometown of Palmyra. They ended up in a refugee camp in Greece and later won asylum in Germany. They were placed in the small town of Traunreuth in Bavaria. Yesterday we heard how they were settling into a new life there. Germany provides housing when people first arrive and some financial support, but the country relies on volunteers to help refugees learn German and begin to navigate daily life. Today, Gene Carstensen reports on how those volunteers and other residents of Traunreuth feel about the refugees arriving in their town.
The Doss family introduces me to their German tutor, Krista Schmidt, over lunch.
She is coming every 2 weeks to learn us some Deutsch. She is nice.
Today, Schmidt is driving a Syrian refugee named Ali to the district capital to help him with some paperwork. We stop at an Arab grocery on the way so Ali can do some shopping. She babies him a little bit and offers to pay, but Ali won't let her. All the help Ali is getting from Schmidt and others in Traunreuth make him optimistic that his new life in Germany will work out.
Syria, gestern 6 Jahre, 7 Jahre, Syria good, und heute nicht gut.
Compared to Syria, he tells me, everything in Germany is good. But Schmidt isn't quite so optimistic. Not just about Ali, but about the future of lots of refugees she knows. Many of the students she tutors are beginners, and she has to start with the very basics, with the alphabet.
I'm starting from scratch with the ABCs and the numbers 1, 2, 3, because it's all completely different from what they know.
She doesn't think very many will ever learn German well. And she's also worried about them finding permanent housing here in Bavaria once their asylum claims have been accepted.
The housing market is really difficult now. It's very tough to find a place to live.
Ali is just starting to look. Schmidt helps him apply for the permit he will need to show potential landlords.
Zimmer 78. Okay. Das alles mit drin, gell? Danke.
Meanwhile, down the hall, I learn more about Bavaria's refugee housing crisis. Every area in Germany is required under federal law to take in its share of refugees. Government spokesperson Roman Schneider tells me that his district has taken in 1,800 and has, at least initially, been able to house them in good conditions.
Not, sage ich jetzt mal, in den Jahren Ende 2014.
We are proud, as a county, that even in the really challenging years, 2014 and 2015, we never had to house the refugees in gyms or bad facilities.
But when it's time for them to leave refugee housing and rent a place of their own, it's almost impossible. Bavaria's real estate market is hot, and landlords can easily get much higher rents than what refugees can pay with their housing stipend. But being able to afford the rent isn't the only challenge. At the refugee housing complex in Traunreuth, I meet Heidi Plank, a volunteer who goes out with refugees on their apartment searches. She says some people think refugees are taking housing away from Germans.
Die Flüchtlinge bekommen die Wohnungen, obwohl die hiesigen auch welche bräuchten.
There's a lot of jealousy. People say that the refugees are getting all the apartments, and poor Germans are not.
Others have watched the news of events in Paris and Cologne and have decided they just don't like refugees, and they won't rent to them.
Deutschland und Europa werden von Flüchtlingen überflutet.
That's a speech from one of the two anti-immigrant rallies that Oliver Koglot organized last year, with support from the far-right Alternative for Germany party. I meet Koglot outside the city hall, where both rallies took place. He says Angela Merkel's open-door policy is allowing too many Muslims into Germany, and he doesn't believe they will integrate.
I would see the solution a lot more in ending the wars and giving that people a chance to go home to rebuild their country, instead of integrating them here, which will not work for the vast number.
Ironically, Koglot is a migrant himself. In fact, 90% of Traunreuth's residents are ethnic German migrants who came from Eastern Europe in several waves beginning in World War II. Koglot came from Romania in 1981 when he was 6 years old.
Does that make you more empathic in some way to the situation of these refugees coming in now?
No. The opposite is true.
Koglot resents today's refugees. When his parents came, he says, it wasn't so easy.
To come from Romania to Germany, where really my parents, they signed the papers, they had to pay 5,000 marks. They had to wait 8 years, they signed that. I was only allowed to bring one box with them, It was really complicated, and not just go through and that's it.
Even though he already spoke German, he had a different accent and felt like an outsider.
In Traunreuth, I felt not like 100% German. I felt like, I must learn the language better. I'm not from here.
The key to integration for Koglot and the other German migrants was mastering German and finding a job.
Speaking German and working, yeah.
Christa Schmidt, the German tutor who helps so many refugees, also has a migrant past. Her family came to Traunreuth in a horse-drawn wagon after World War II, when Stalin expelled many Germans from Romania.
Mit Pferd und Wagen und Kindern. Die waren mit 5 Kindern unterwegs, mit 3 eigenen und 2 Cousinen.
My mother told me that at the end of the war, she had to come here with 5 kids, with just a horse and a wagon. And my father was away, working as a tailor at the Dachau concentration camp. It was a very hard time.
But unlike Koglot, her family's experiences make her empathize with today's refugees. I know she is worried about the obstacles they face, learning German so they can work, and finding a good permanent place to live. But I'm still surprised by how few refugees she thinks will integrate.
I think 5 or 6% will integrate. I don't think it will be more. That will take generations. But if in a few years 6 or 7% succeed, I think we'll be lucky.
So that's the underlying tension I sense in Traunreuth and Bavaria. There's a lot of goodwill. Citizens like Schmidt are volunteering, and the government has a can-do attitude. But those same players who say, we're helping, they doubt integration can actually work. Maybe the district spokesperson, Roman Schneider, sums up the ambivalence best.
Many people just say, all right, they're here now, so let's make the best of it.
For The World, Jean Carstensen, Traunreuth, Germany.
Jean's reporting on refugees is supported by the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's Climate Balancing Act. That story is just ahead, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. I'm sure you remember the Keystone XL pipeline, the super controversial link between Canada's tar sands and U.S. refineries to the south. President Obama killed the project, citing environmental concerns. Then President Trump reversed that decision. But Trump isn't the pipeline's only big backer. It also has a good friend in Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, which may surprise you if all you know about Trudeau is that he's a shining new liberal light to the north. Turns out when it comes to energy and climate, Trudeau's trying to pull off a risky high-wire act. Here's reporter Brian Mann.
For a lot of Americans these days, Justin Trudeau is the anti-Donald Trump, especially on things like climate change. While President Trump moves to pull America out of the Paris Climate Accords, Canada's prime minister describes carbon pollution as one of the globe's biggest dangers.
We know that it will be the world's poorest citizens who will be hardest hit by climate change, displaced by rising sea levels, left hungry by failed crops, and more vulnerable to disease.
Not long after taking office in 2015, Trudeau unveiled a sweeping national plan to pivot Canada to a new economy based on renewable energy.
Today, we made an important down payment on that cleaner future with a new continental climate change strategy.
Trudeau's plan is bold. He wants to end Canada's use of coal to generate electricity. He's proposed a national tax on carbon pollution and wants to make big investments in clean energy technology. This is the Justin Trudeau who grabs headlines in the U.S., green and progressive. But Trudeau sounds like a whole different politician when he talks about Canadian oil.
No country would find 173 billion barrels of oil in the ground and just leave them there.
The oil in Canada's tar sands region in Alberta is one of the biggest reserves in the world, and Trudeau is determined to keep it flowing.
We're on our way to getting three new pipeline projects underway, which will help connect Canada's oil patch with energy markets around the world.
That applause is from a gathering of oil and gas executives in Texas, where the prime minister spoke earlier this year. Canada is already the biggest foreign supplier of oil to the U.S., but Trudeau has pushed even harder than Trump for controversial pipelines like Keystone XL to get tar sands oil to more markets. Oil and natural gas revenue helps drive Canada's economy and also pays for a lot of the big social programs that some Americans envy, like its national healthcare system. The catch is that the tar sands produce some of the filthiest oil in the world, and critics say continuing to dig it up will turn Trudeau's climate promises to smoke.
He's as big a hypocrite as there is.
That's Bill McKibben, one of the leading climate activists in the U.S.
I don't know whether he's confused or he's a just straight-up liar, but those seem like the two possibilities.
McKibben says the science is clear. If Trudeau keeps tar sands oil flowing, it'll set off a carbon bomb. And Trudeau's balancing act is bringing similar condemnation from the other side.
There is one of two things, Mr. Prime Minister. You're either a liar or you're confused. And I'm beginning to think it's both.
That's oil worker Merle Terlevsky. Many in the industry here don't buy Trudeau's promises. They believe his carbon tax and other environmental measures will hurt their industry. Terlevsky blasted Trudeau at a town hall meeting in Alberta.
Because you cannot come down to this province and attack the single biggest employer.
Oil drives the economy and the culture of Alberta more than any other part of Canada. There's a reason their hockey team is called the Oilers. But growing the industry comes at a huge cost, not just more carbon pollution, but also destroyed forests, massive strip mines. I chartered a plane to fly over the tar sands, mile after mile of forest scoured away by trucks and bulldozers big as office buildings. Sludge pools the size of lakes are filled with contaminated wastewater. There are massive yellow pyramids built entirely out of sulfur squeezed from tar sands oil.
Now, there are people that have referred to it as looking like a war zone or Mordor.
Ariel Deranger is an Athabasca Chipewyan First Nations activist, founder of a group called Indigenous Climate Action. She says Trudeau's push for tar sands development has put the prime minister at odds with many Aboriginal communities.
These places that I once knew as a child were just literally bulldozed over. And it's a very visceral feeling of death.
By embracing big oil, Trudeau hopes to win enough political backing in Canada's western provinces to push through his wider environment agenda. And energy experts and economists I talk to say those policies will likely reduce Canada's domestic carbon emissions significantly. But there's another big wrinkle. Under the Paris Climate Accord, carbon pollution is measured in the country where fossil fuels are burned, not where they're produced. So it's possible Canada will soon be bragging about significant cuts to carbon pollution here at home while contributing to a spike in pollution elsewhere. In fact, Trudeau is so committed to boosting Canada's oil exports that he appointed a trade lawyer, not a scientist or energy expert, to serve as Canada's Minister of the Environment and Climate Change.
I'm as much an economic minister as I am an environment minister.
That's Environment Minister Catherine McKenna. She spoke during a recent visit to Washington, where she boasted about Trudeau's success at that oil industry conference.
He made the case the environment and the economy go together.
But even some of Trudeau's strongest supporters say the line Trudeau is trying to walk, climate change warrior and big oil champion, just doesn't work. Elizabeth May, who leads Canada's Green Party, describes the Prime Minister as a friend and says she's convinced Trudeau understands that tar sands oil is a threat to the planet.
It's not a political test, it's a test of character. What's more important, your kids' future or standing ovations in Houston?
So there are a lot of unanswered questions about Justin Trudeau's leadership in the fight against climate change. What's certain is that the pipelines and refineries Trudeau is pushing for will tie Canada's economy and the world's to tar sands oil for decades to come, even as the impacts of climate change he warns about continue to mount. For The World, Brian Mann, Fort McMurray, Alberta.
One more quick news note before we take a break. Jeff Sessions was in the spotlight today, a day after his boss, President Trump, told the New York Times he regretted hiring him as attorney general. Trump claimed it was extremely unfair to the president for Sessions to recuse himself from the ongoing Russia investigation. Today, Sessions told reporters he loved his job and would continue to do it as long as it is appropriate. Now, the purpose of his appearance was actually to announce the shutdown of Alpha Bay. That's a dark website selling illegal drugs, weapons, fake documents, other criminal stuff. Here's Sessions.
This is the largest dark market web place takedown in world history. An Alpha Bay staff member claimed that this group serviced more than 40,000 illegal vendors, people who sell illegal products, for more than 200,000 customers. By far, most of this activity was in illegal drugs, pouring fuel on the fire of the national drug epidemic.
Alpha Bay was taken down with help from Europol. Rob Wainwright is the director of the European Law Enforcement Agency.
There's a very strong message here to those who engage in criminal activity on the internet, and the darknet especially, that you're not as safe and you're not as anonymous as you think you are. And this operation is an example of the improving concerted ability of law enforcement to strike against criminals, even on the darknet.
Sounds a lot like what officials said after the closure of the Silk Road website back in 2013. Alpha Bay rose to prominence after that. So the question now is probably, who's next? Will history repeat itself again? I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, a conversation with Iranian-American author Lale Khedivi.
This experiment that is America, this experiment that is the idea of many tribes living and eventually blending together, people will individually put up walls.
Her new novel is about a surfer dude turned jihadi. That's still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. President Trump is reportedly pulling the plug on U.S. support for moderate rebel groups in Syria. We reported on that earlier in the show, but that doesn't spell the end of American involvement in the Syrian war. Right now, the U.S. is actively backing a coalition of forces trying to drive ISIS militants from Raqqa. That's the self-proclaimed ISIS capital in Syria. My BBC colleague Gabriel Gatehouse has been to the front lines near the city. And recently, he met some women who've experienced both sides of the conflict. His story begins in a camp not far from Raqqa.
Until recently, all of these people lived under the harsh regime of Islamic State, not all against their will. One corner of the camp is reserved for the wives and children of IS fighters. Here, we get a glimpse of a sisterhood of a more sinister kind.
We spent time with the sisters. They didn't like anything we did and kept screaming at my children and me.
That's Noor. The sisters she refers to are other IS widows. She's 20 years old and from Lebanon. She came to the caliphate with her husband, a jihadi. When he was killed, she was housed in a dormitory for fighters' widows, whose lives were strictly controlled.
I spent 5 months at a guest house. It was better there, and they taught us the Quran and Sharia law. But the prince there controlled us. He was controlling me as if he were my husband. He would say to me that it is forbidden to be outside the guest house.
To better her situation, Noor married again, a Tunisian. As the wife of a foreign fighter, she was in a relatively privileged position. There were many others, especially Yazidis, whose fates were much darker. Women captured and sold between the fighters as sex slaves.
What they did with them, they took off all their clothes and they brought a doctor. This was how they knew if the women were a virgin or not. He asked them to take off their clothes. They put the married women in one house and the virgins in another house. And in the Yazidi town of Sinjar, the fighters took the women they liked.
These sex slaves are a feature of life in Islamic State.
There was a lot of tension between the wives and the sex slaves. Some of the women even divorced their husbands because of it. The men started buying lots of the sex slaves. My first husband had an app on his phone. It was a market for sex slaves. They were sharing photos of them wearing the best makeup and clothes. A virgin cost $10,000.
Meanwhile, the Syrian Democratic Forces are closing in on the center of Raqqa. Commander Sonhuin and her unit are on the western front. It's a tight squeeze inside a homemade armored truck with a couple of her fighters driving towards the center of Raqqa. Sonhuin is a Kurdish military commander. For the Kurds, the fight against IS is part of a wider struggle for a long-held dream of self-determination. But for Sonhuin, the youngest daughter of 11 children in a conservative society, this battle is also a social revolution, and it's personal.
I used to wonder as a child already, why are men always more important than women? In this war, we have the chance to show that we are human too and able to do everything in our power to build a new world here. Defeating IS is not only a military goal. We will liberate Raqqa, yes. But the most important battle is that over beliefs, views, and attitudes.
Commander Sonhuin, ending that report from the BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse in Syria. One of the things that gets in the way if you're a surfer, localism. The locals who surf year-round ain't always crazy about non-locals on their waves. That's not a problem for Reza, or Rez. The main character in Lala Khedive's new novel is a local until he's not treated as one. Khedive says she's always been fascinated by the subculture of Southern California surfers. She calls those who ride the waves there a tribe unto themselves.
These surfers have found their god, it is the ocean, and they will come every day and pay homage to it.
But for Rez, the surfer dude protagonist in Khedive's new novel, the search for God and meaning in life is anything but mellow. Rez is the college-bound son of wealthy Iranian immigrants who enjoys riding the waves and getting stoned until something profound shifts beneath him and he falls into radical Islam. Lala Khedive, thank you very much for being with us. So much of this book is set on windswept beaches where a set of very privileged teenage boys hang out and surf. It kind of seems like an unlikely place to try to grasp what drives today's militants.
I think that's true at the outset of it, but I don't know if you remember, adolescence is a time of great shift and change.
Oh, I do.
And I wanted, it's hard to forget, I wanted to track what happens in the most extreme case. And my models for this were not Americans, because the radicalization of youth has not been as prevalent in the United States. My models were the European kids who had come with their parents or had been born in the West after a migration and grown up in countries like Germany, France, the UK, that had accepted them only partially. There was always a ceiling or a cap. And in the face of that, they found the lure of organizations like ISIS or fundamentalist organizations very appealing because there was no cap. There was only total belonging.
Mm. Right. So it's that teenage experience, and that teenage experience has so many life-changing moments when sides are chosen, and those moments are nuanced and they're personal, and you write about those moments so well. The protagonist, Reza or Rez, at first seems to fit in with these WASPy California golden boys, and there are these split-second moments when it becomes painfully clear to him that he is the brown kid. I'd just like it if you could describe one of those moments for us, like the return trip from Mexico.
So Rez makes these grand attempts to become a sort of hero of his group. And he thinks that if he can prove to these guys, these dudes, that he is savvy in the ways of surfing and in the ways of, you know, smoking pot and in the ways of sex, that he can then be accepted. And he makes a gamble and takes them south to Mexico. And they go on a big illicit surf trip to Baja. Their parents don't know that they're gone. They take a bunch of surfboards and one of their brother's trucks. And the truck ends up being vandalized and they end up being robbed. And Rez is to blame because the trip was his idea, and he loses the gamble. And slowly, that group that he wanted admission to so badly begins to turn against him. And instead of turning against him for, oh, man, you messed up, or God, that really sucked, they turned against him in the way that took on his name and his heritage and said, this happened because you're not one of us.
There's another moment like that when Rez is pulled out of line at the airport and questioned by a security officer.
Yeah, he's coming back from another surf trip with his good friend. And in writing that scene, I felt as if I didn't really even have to do that much imagining. I felt, especially in our new world, that you could actually come up to a situation where you are a certified citizen of the United States with a blue passport. And because of your name and because of perhaps the place you were born and the place your parents were born, you would be under suspicion. And it was this sort of suspicion that just gets cast upon him immediately. His friend goes through. His friend is a Anglo-Saxon Protestant American, and he, with the Iranian parents, gets held back. Mm. And in the holding back, the two border people give him a little lecture in which he is told very clearly about the ceiling that I was talking to, about the fact that you can be as successful as you want as a immigrant in this country, and you will be accepted into certain places, but there are certain places in which perhaps you may not be accepted. So all of your striving, all of your achievement, all of your contributions can only make for a certain place. It's kind of a big heartbreak for Rez to be in that room and hear those words and notice that, you know, the dream of the American life is not actually totally available in that moment.
Some people might use the term microaggressions to describe moments like these insulting moments. Is that what you call them? And is that what they are for Rez in your novel?
I don't call them microaggressions. That is sort of a new term that I haven't totally wrestled with yet. But I think what they are is a testament to the fact that no matter how we try as humans, this experiment that is America, this experiment that is the idea of many tribes living and eventually blending together, people will individually put up walls. They will put up walls around themselves and around their faith groups or around their geographical groups or around their class or around their ethnicities, and they will judge from behind those walls because we have not yet figured out a way to truly merge with one another peacefully and without the hesitations of racism and prejudice and judgment. Those are present still. And I think that rather than microaggressions, they just happen to be the reality of us all trying to be in the same place at the same time.
How does Rez start to process the cumulative effects of these moments?
When he's young, he doesn't notice. There is no weight to them. But as he gets older and as the world becomes more fraught, as the notion of hostility between peoples comes closer to home and the acts of violence become something local rather than something he just hears about in the news, he begins to feel the brunt of this exclusion and the brunt of this discrimination. And it piles up to a point where there is, you know, a final straw. And it's not even something that happens to him, but something that happens to the girl he has a crush on, Fatima. And he realizes that there is another way to be a man in the world. And he's got to seek that out. And it's this seeking of personhood, of acceptance of a kind of power as an individual and a citizen that I think a lot of the adolescents who have gone towards ISIS have been looking for, and Rez is no different. He just cannot sort of take it anymore and wants to go to a more powerful place.
He becomes radicalized.
He becomes radicalized.
So yeah. I want listeners to appreciate the story, so no spoilers. But what's at stake if teenagers don't dial in to this discrimination that they might be leveling at others? I mean, do you think we understand as a country how tough these things can be for teenagers?
I think when it comes to teenagers, there's a way in which we have to be especially sensitive to their fluidity, to the fact that they are constantly looking for a group to fit inside of. And if groups keep leaving them out, they're going to keep looking for a group. And that group might not be on this soil. It might be on the internet. It might be far away. And it might provide a deeper lure than anything that can come here with success in school or financial success or any of the other markers that make people feel comfortable.
Author Lale Khedive's new novel is A Good Country. It was really wonderful to speak with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Yes. My husband has been saying the drum music from your show for like the past 3 days. Thanks for seeking out the book.
Take care. Three. That's how many northern white rhinos are left in the entire world. So researchers are going to great lengths to try and give these animals a fighting chance. Here's my BBC colleague, Rebecca Morell.
This really is conservation science at its most extreme. I've just come back from Longleat Safari Park in the southwest of England to see a rhino undergoing an experimental fertility treatment. She was a young female called Ibun, 7 years old, and she was sedated. You can actually hear her here in a deep sleep. A team of scientists were there to collect her eggs. And it was an amazing process to see, but a very risky one too. As one of the scientists, Thomas Hildebrandt from the Leibniz Institute for Zoo and Wildlife Research in Berlin, explained.
So it's very well established in human beings. It's very well established in the livestock industry, but we have a 2-ton animal. The ovaries are more than 2 meters inside, and you can't use the classical approach. So we have developed a totally new technology.
So why were the team collecting eggs? Well, Ibun is a southern white rhino, and the hope is that she can help to save a closely related species, the northern white rhino. Northern whites were once found across Central Africa, but they were heavily poached, totally wiped out in the wild. And today there are just 3 of the animals left, and they're now kept under the tightest security in Kenya. But unfortunately, because of a combination of age and fertility problems, they're unable to breed. So the plan is to fertilise the southern white rhino eggs to create southern white rhino embryos. If that works, the team then wants to repeat the technique with the remaining northern white rhinos, and it could help to bring the species back from the brink. But if they can't produce northern white rhinos, they do have a plan B, and that's to mix the southern white eggs that they're collecting with northern white rhino sperm and create a hybrid. Robert Hermes, who's also from the Leibniz Institute, says doing something like this is better than losing the northern white rhino altogether.
If we had a hybrid embryo, we would preserve at least half of this for future generations.
Now, the project does have critics. Some wildlife experts say that rather than putting so much resources into a species that's almost certainly doomed, more effort should be made to save other rhinos. But the team involved with this scheme say that while there's a chance to help the northern white rhino, the technology should at least be tried out. And they also say if this can help to pull northern white rhinos back from the brink, there's also a chance that the same fertility technology could help other endangered species too.
The BBC's Rebecca Morell reporting there. When President Trump visited Poland recently, he praised the country for battling through decades of adversity to a successful democracy. But many in the country worry that Poland's democracy is under threat. Today, the Polish parliament, controlled by the far-right Law and Justice Party, gave initial approval to a measure that would give the ruling party control over the judiciary. That happened despite a European Union warning that Poland could lose its EU voting rights as a result. I asked Christian Davies to explain the measure. He covers Poland for The Guardian.
The bill that was just passed today has to be seen as a part of a series of legislation that was been passed over the last week or so. The first gave Parliament political control over the body that appoints Polish judges. The second gave the Minister of Justice the ability to dismiss and appoint court presidents, who are the judges who decide which judges sit on which cases. And this bill will terminate the appointments of all 83 Supreme Court judges and give the governing party control over who replaces them.
So why is this so controversial?
Well, when judges are dependent on the patronage of the ruling party, and when the ruling party can choose who can sit on which case, then you no longer have a proper separation of powers. And that has very worrying implications for human rights and democracy and the rule of law.
Earlier today, I spoke with Tomasz Sakiewicz, who's editor-in-chief of the Polish right-wing newspaper Gazeta Polska, and here's how he defended the government.
I think that nobody wants to control justice in Poland. We want to change it to reform because it's completely broken by corruption and mafia's system.
Yeah, he says it's corrupt and it's a mafia system. Is that pretty much in line with what the government has been saying?
Yes, that's what it says. It's very easy to talk about, in general terms, about corruption and a mafia system. You've got to substantiate claims like that. And it's not satisfactory to push through, in the course of less than a week, such a radical reform, so-called, of a judicial system, with no public consultation and with no proper discussion of any opposition amendments.
Now, leading up to the passage of the bill today, thousands of people were protesting in front of the Polish parliament against this measure. What was that scene like?
The opposition protests, they remind me of finals day at Wimbledon. These tend to be middle-class people who are angry but don't necessarily express themselves in a particularly forceful way. There's a lot of sort of picnics and people with their dogs and so on, with sort of quite witty slogans. But there hasn't yet been any violence or actually really forceful expressions of anger, which I found slightly surprising.
There have been expressions of sadness and serious disappointment, though. We spoke with Polish activist Marta Lampert earlier today, just a couple of minutes, in fact, after she heard this bill pass the lower house, and she sounded pretty darn heartbroken.
This is a really hard moment, you know.
I understand. But, yeah, I can hear that in your voice.
Please remember us. Please mention us. Please speak about us.
We are.
Thank you.
Lempart says the protesters are going to put pressure now on President Andrzej Duda to veto the bill. What's the likelihood that'll happen?
I cry hot, salty tears at the naivety of people who think that Andrzej Duda is going to save them. President Duda has shown no initiative to stand up against the government in the entire time he's been president.
So do you think the EU is going to kick Poland out?
No, we're a very long way from that. Poland has been in dialogue, as it's called, with the European Commission. The Commission's patience is clearly running out, and it's very possible that they will recommend possible sanctions against Poland. That is politically very tricky because it may look as if the European Union is trying to interfere in Polish internal affairs. At the same time, support for European Union membership in Poland is extremely high, one of the highest levels of support in the whole European Union. And it looks like it will slightly come down to how Polish public reaction will turn. Either they will feel that their government is being bullied by Brussels, or they will feel ashamed that the government is starting a war with Brussels over this. And it's not quite clear which way it will turn. But actual expulsion is a very long way off.
Christian Davies reports for The Guardian in Warsaw. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
I had this experience recently. I was in a lift going to a show by a cool band from Zimbabwe called Mukumba. The driver from Haiti was playing some loud Jamaican dance hall. I had Mukumba's CD with me, so I asked him if he'd mind changing the music. He said sure, and he liked what he heard. But when this track came on, he really started grooving. He said it sounded like Compas from Haiti. I let the driver keep the CD. I love moments like that. I told the band about it, and they loved it too. Mukumba plays music from Zimbabwe and Southern Africa. They steer away from politics and any critique of their 93-year-old president, Robert Mugabe. I asked bass player Abundance Mutori about that.
We don't talk about politics mainly because we are about the riches of styles of music, and we've been continuing to give the good vibe to the world, also to Zimbabwe and to whoever we meet.
It's that good vibe that I'm really curious about because, I mean, you don't talk about politics, fair enough, but it's against a backdrop of real economic hardship in Zimbabwe and this rule of this president for so many years, and the economy doesn't improve. So it's against that backdrop that you guys have gotten really popular. And I'm just wondering, what has it been that you have brought to the people of Zimbabwe that somehow provides some relief or some solace?
Yeah, I think it's this kind of good relief in music, because music is, I think, we believe it's a tool that also can bring forth like hope, good feeling. You know, if we have positive message, like we are always hoping, like we're the youth, and we always hoped to have like the best of what we can have for our country, for our people. So, I mean, this is why I also sing song that talk about HIV and AIDS on this album, that we're conscientizing youth to take heed of those kind of like elements that are like day-to-day life, that are hindrance to life, so that we can have a better future.
We'll leave you with a little more of Zimbabwe's Mukumba. They're touring the States right now, second time this year, so they're getting a lot of American love. Maybe you can show them some before they head home in 2 weeks' time. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Hope you can come back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.